This is fairly informal, but I'm going to call the Legislative Reentry Working Group to order. And thank you all for coming today. I know we all know each other, but just for the tape, I think what I'd like to do is just have us introduce ourselves and who you represent, and then we'll begin with our agenda today. So, Isabel, maybe we'll start with you.
I'm Isabel Gomez, from the Director of the Sentencing Guidelines Committee.
Ron Lambert, Contracts and Grants Manager, Hennepin County Community Corrections.
Welcome, Ron.
Thank you.
Gary Johnson, Director of Reentry Services for the Department of Corrections.
Wendy Higgins, State Senator, North Minneapolis and Downtown.
Gary Carter, staff at the House of Representatives, Bristol, Iowa.
And Michael Paymar, House of Representatives.
Melanie Lacombe, Committee Administrator for the Public Safety Finance Division, House of Representatives.
Rob Eastland, State Representative, District 17A.
Dennis Benson, Deputy Commissioner of Corrections.
Jeff Shorva, Deputy State Court Administrator with the Judicial Branch.
Andy Erickson, I'm Deputy Director of Adult Probation in Ramsey County.
Okay, well, and Libby Wyrum, who is my Legislative Assistant here. Well, thank you all and the public for coming also. The purpose of this working group is to gather as much information as possible about how we may do some things different relative to reentry. This is a controversial issue, but it's clearly something that is going on across the country as we try to deal with the soaring population in our prisons and what we're going to do about this population as they get out. So today what we wanted to do was just explore the whole history of how we moved from indeterminate sentencing to determinate sentencing. Our Sentencing Guidelines Commission and whether any of that can or should be tweaked at all and I think we just need to have a dialogue about what's going on with this increased population. And I'm pleased that Deb Bailey, who was the chair of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, is here. I understand. I didn't realize that you actually started when all of this started in the 1970s. So we're going to get hopefully an interesting historical overview about the whole system. I know you have some prepared comments, and then we'll open it up for questions. There we have it. So, Deb, thank you very much.
Great. Thank you, Representative Paymar. I am Deb Bailey. I currently work as the Research and Evaluation Manager in the State Court Administration Office. I've been there since 2001. But prior to that, I spent my life career in sentencing guidelines. I started out there fresh out of college, mm-hmm. And that was back in 1979, I have to say. And from there, kind of did a lot of work in the data analysis or research area, and then became director in 1985 and remained the director of the Sentencing Commission until 2001. It was an extraordinary experience for me. I have to say, just as a young person coming out of college, I can't think of any experience better than to jump into this sort of very, very noble, I think, cause of trying to figure out what to do about the sentencing of offenders in our society and how to address that in the most rational and effective way. It was a huge challenge, and it's still a challenge. I mean, it never ends. And so I thank you for the opportunity. I, by all means, do not pretend to be the expert. I'm just one person with a perspective, and I know that there are many of you around the table who have a good expertise in this area. So I'm just going to give you, you know, my impression of what I understood where we came from and what we were trying to accomplish. As you know, prior to 1980, we had an indeterminate sentencing system where the legislature would set penalties and set the description of crimes, and it would be 0 to 10, 0 to 5, 0 to 20 years, and that there was a parole board who would make the decision as to how long someone would stay in prison. Judges would decide who should go to prison. So you kind of had two different entities making decisions about what would happen to criminals. But there was a lot of discontent brewing back in the 70s about that type of system and whether it was the most effective way to address the question of how long people should stay in prison. In particular, there was some disillusionment with the idea that not that whether we could rehabilitate offenders in prison, you know, whether there were good programs and whether there were good things we could do while people were in prison, but whether the decision to release them should be based on some sort of impression about whether they were rehabilitated, because that's indeed what we were trying to accomplish with the parole board, was determining whether we thought they were ready to go back into society. And interestingly enough, what I recall hearing about was that there was sort of folks on both sides of the coin there. There were folks who were concerned about the parole board releasing folks too soon because they thought they were rehabilitated and had exhibited ability to get back into society, yet it diminished the seriousness of the crime that they committed. So they were concerned about that. But there were also some other folks, not the same folks usually, were concerned about people not getting out of prison, who perhaps had not committed as serious of a crime, but yet weren't necessarily able to exhibit evidence of being rehabilitated. And so there were those two concerns, and overall then there was a concern for having greater uniformity in that decision process. And they were also, quite frankly, concerned about the judicial decisions, about who they were sending to prison, and whether they were making those decisions on the basis of seriousness. So a lot of concern about discretion, a lot of concern about who had the discretion and how it was being carried out. And at that time, there was discussions about states moving towards more determinate systems. And there, nonetheless, was concern here about doing that, about strictly going to a determinate system where, by statute, for instance, you would simply prescribe what should happen to someone. Because if you went to a system like that, now you're talking about pretty much putting the discretion mostly into the hands of prosecutors, because primarily whatever they would decide to charge and pursue a conviction for would then determine what would happen to someone in terms of the sentence. And so there was definitely reluctance to do that. And so around about that time, there was a little bit of experience with this concept of sentencing guidelines. State of New Jersey, had enacted some judicial sentencing guidelines. And there had been a very famous book that came out in the 70s. Marvin Frankel had written a book called Criminal Sentences, Law Without Order. And in that was a recommendation for this concept of sentencing commission and to have sort of another way of sort of moving towards more determinate sentences, but without having it be just a total strict system that was defined by statute. And so Minnesota took a look at those ideas and decided that it was kind of a compromise between going that strict route of determinate sentencing or sticking with the parole system, but rather taking a sentencing guideline system that would give them a number of different ways to address the sentencing of offenders in a very rational, kind of uniform and proportional approach. The idea of sentencing guidelines obviously offers the ability for judges to play a role in discretion. They would still decide who should go to prison. They would decide how long someone should go to prison. But their decisions would be public, they would be upfront, and if they didn't follow the guidelines, which would be allowed as a departure, they would have to indicate their reasons. And so that sort of brought into focus the idea that they would be held accountable for their discretion. The other aspect that Minnesota did that was new and unique was to decide that those decisions would be appealable. So that was the other sort of balance of discretion and accountability that Minnesota placed on this process, was to say to judges, yes, you can depart, but prosecution or the defense can appeal those sentences. So Minnesota then was the very first state to decide to do this type of idea as a legislative body. It was really the legislature that determined they wanted to go forward with this, and they developed a law that allowed for a sentencing commission to be created and to move forward in developing the guidelines. And so it very much was different from what New Jersey had done, and it really was the first state in the country to have a legislatively mandated sentencing guideline system. Then what happened after that was really a lot of effort being put forth to figuring out how to develop the best sentencing guideline system and one that would really work most effectively. And just I'll just a couple of notes that I'll make in regard to that was that the sentencing commission that was created by the legislature, consisting of folks from across the whole criminal justice system to represent widely everyone's perspective, they decided to approach sentencing guidelines more from a just desserts philosophy. Again, it wasn't to say that rehabilitation wasn't important, but this was a big shift in philosophy in that, first and foremost, people were going to have their sentences set in guidelines based on more of a just desserts concept. That is, the more serious your offense, the more severe your sentence would be. And the more serious your prior record, the more severe your sentence would be. Regardless of whether you ended up going to prison and be the shining star in terms of your ability to function well in prison, the sentence would be the sentence, and you would serve that. Minnesota recognized they needed to have some ability to encourage offenders to exhibit good behavior, so we did create the concept of good time, which I believe is now bad time, which means that if you're disruptive, you get more time added on to your sentence. That was viewed all along as something very important to have included into the whole correctional scheme, that you couldn't just put them in prison and let them out without any sort of end to their sentence, and that they could earn this good time and get out and then spend that period of time on a supervised period of time. The other note I want to make about what shifts occurred here under sentencing guidelines is that it really dramatically changed the makeup of our prison system. Because the focus was more on just desserts, because it was on the seriousness of the crime and the idea of creating some proportionality with respect to the crimes and sentences, we shifted from having a prison system that had mostly property offenders to one that had mostly person offenders. And that was very, very meaningful. But in the development of sentencing guidelines, what also needs to be recognized is that the legislature very much wanted the commission to try to make the necessary resources that would be needed to house offenders not change. That is, they wanted the commission to establish guidelines that, while they might shift who was in prison and for how long, the makeup of who was there, that it wouldn't necessarily increase the number of prison beds we would need to go to that new system. And so there were a lot of, you know, decisions made, you know, a lot of question about, well, if these folks go to prison for this long, then that means, you know, these folks obviously cannot go to prison for this long because we won't have enough space. And so a lot of effort was taken to try to have a resource neutral product that would then, you know, provide for no immediate increase to the prison population. So that I just wanted to point out that was actually part of the legislation that was in place at the time to institute the sentencing guidelines. Now, as you probably all know, that concept of the relationship between the policy and the resources has been retained over the years, and it has never really meant that you can't build new prisons or that you don't want to increase the sentence length of folks so that you can, follow what you believe is the right thing to do. But it has enabled, I believe, the legislature to always go hand in hand with the policy and the resources, so that when you determined the commission in hand in hand with the commission that you wanted to increase sentences, you in turn then knew what that would mean in terms of prison resources. And so that's the other sort of point about sentencing guidelines, is that they offer that predictability about what your resource needs will be, because you have a very clear policy about what you're going to do. You have a very clear structure for how that will be carried out by the court system, and you know when you're going to release people, and so you have the ability to be more clear about what your resource needs are going to be. And again, it doesn't mean you're not going to be pressured from time to time, but those resources are going to come forth and show themselves in ways that you are going to have to deal with them, but it is a mechanism that you have in place that can allow you to deal with the resource needs. I guess, you know, I would say that obviously over time, many things have occurred with the sentencing guidelines. the just desserts philosophy has, for the most part, been retained, but it certainly hasn't been the only philosophy in place. All of the folks, for instance, who do not go to prison, who end up in the community, are pretty much governed by what the judge determines to be the appropriate sanction in the community. We certainly have probation officers who do what they can to try to address the needs and what we do with folks who aren't going to prison. And so the guidelines don't cover the whole gamut of what happens to people, but they pretty much focus on the prison question as to who goes to prison and when do they get released, and trying to stick with that being in proportion to the crime that they're convicted for and their criminal history. So in conclusion, or in summary, I think that you could say that the values that are represented by the sentencing guidelines system are the values of uniformity and fairness, to create a mechanism for you to ensure that you do have fairness in sentencing and uniformity, a system of proportionality to ensure that those sentences are in proportion, as I mentioned before, to the offense for which they were convicted and their criminal history. It also takes into the value of accountability. I think this is a real important one, in that, you know, because you are having the court system make these decisions up front, they're in a public arena, people are being held accountable for their decisions up front. I think there's all of that built in. Their decisions to depart are up front, and they're held accountable for that. I think another value is the balance of discretion. I think under a sentencing guideline system, you have many actors that have a role in terms of their contribution to this decision, and that there is no one player that has all of the discretion. And you've got both the legislature setting broad penalties and having the legislature set what is a crime and what are the details of that. And you've got prosecutors still determining what should be the conviction, of course, for the offense. And then you have judges stepping in and determining what that sentence should be. And so you've got different branches of the government, and you've got, you know, different ways of balancing that discretion. And then finally, I think the predictability is a very important value as well, because this system does give you, as I mentioned, some aspect of predictability for matching up what your policy is going to be as far as sentencing goes with what your resource needs will be on the back end as far as prison. Doesn't deal with the jail, but it does deal with the prison, and so I think that that's certainly a value that's carried out by sentencing guidelines.
Thank you, Ms. Daly. I would like to, those two people just joined us, if you could, we already did introductions, if you could just introduce yourselves and who you represent, that would be helpful.
I'm Dan Kane with RSB.
I'm John Stewart, I'm the State Public Defender.
Welcome.
Thank you.
I'm Sarah Wolf, I'm here on behalf of Susan Gertner, Ramsey County Attorney.
Okay, welcome. I don't know if you were here last time, I wasn't here, but Representative Eastland was chairing the meeting. But well, thank you very much, Deb, for that overview. I'll open it up for questions. But one thing you didn't touch on very much was the abolition of the parole board, and so I'm just wondering, if you could talk a little bit about that, did we do the right thing? Did we make a mistake? I mean, what is the incentive for offenders who are now incarcerated to go to treatment, to get job training while they're incarcerated? Was that examined when we abolished the parole board?
Well, it's my understanding that, you know, it was from the perspective of we wouldn't have a parole board any longer making the decision about when someone should be released. There was no one that was giving up on having, you know, programs in prison that would address the needs of offenders to help assist them when they got out. And I think that primarily with respect to the good time, bad time, it's really with respect to that it was believed that could be certainly a motivator to get inmates to do what they needed to do while they were in prison, because if not, then they could extend their time by a third. So you've got the two-thirds that would for sure be spent in prison based on the sentencing guidelines, recommendations, sentence, or whatever the judge gave, and then the remaining third was time that they could end up serving if they really didn't comply with various types of requirements as a prison inmate. And I probably can't speak to that as well as some other people might be able to in terms of how that actually has worked and how it's been carried out. But from the purposes of folks who were looking at a sentencing guideline system and a more of a determinant system, it was believed that was sufficient to motivate them. And it was also believed that they did not want the decision to release the inmate to be based on some impression that they really, you know, did really well in prison versus somebody else who it was believed didn't do very well in prison. But it was really, it needed to be based first and foremost on the seriousness of their offense and their criminal history. And then apart from that, you would have this bad time component that could be added on.
I'll open it up for questions, and we can, I also ask that if you just be part of the discussion too, so it doesn't have to be totally focused on her presentation or knowledge of sentencing guidelines, but let's just have a broad discussion here. Stuart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I was at the discussion of the possible re-ranking of drug sentences a couple of weeks ago, and I heard that 70% of the drug offenses are departures now, but that geographically it's not very even. And I want to ask...
Excuse me, it's 40%.
My recollection from that meeting is that geographically it's rather uneven, that there's some parts of the state where you get roughly twice as many mitigated departures as other parts of the state. And I wonder how that can be reconciled with uniformity and fairness and with having eliminated disparities. It concerns me that some places just don't depart. And other places depart systematically.
Mm-hmm. Someone want to take that up?
Well,
at
risk of alienating my employers, I've got to say that as the updated drug report that the Commission prepared pointed out in February, the message of the departures is that when departures are at that point, there need to be changes in the law. That is to say, there appears to what is manifested by the departures is a widespread dissatisfaction with the law, which does not distinguish adequately. And I think everybody agrees to this. It was really interesting when we gathered comments prior to the Commission's determining how to re-rank. It was interesting that pretty much we universally agree that one of the huge problems with our laws is that they don't distinguish between people who are serious offenders, or that is clearer, don't distinguish between people who make their living selling drugs and people who possess drugs. This is a huge problem, and so on. So I would just say that, in all honesty, what would have to happen in order to make that right would be such changes as definitions of a, quote, kingpin, unquote, or seller, raising of thresholds, or, you know, setting different thresholds for different punishments and so on. So, you know, I think there was pretty widespread agreement about that as well in these comments. There were some areas of disagreement, of course.
Was this at your last meeting, then, to discuss?
We've had three, actually, since the legislative mandate to be ranked.
Okay.
And pretty much the agreement is, and my employers agree with this, that re-ranking is not the whole answer by any means, and may not be the best answer, but that it would have to come in the context of other changes in the law.
Mr. Kane?
Mr. Chair, Deb, a couple of questions. Immediately after the implementation of the guidelines, the proportion of violent offenders to property offenders, at least after there was enough time for
attrition changed dramatically to be largely in keeping of what the legislature described as their intent when they were debating guidelines legislation. Do you recall what that ratio became, and do you have any knowledge about what it might be now?
Ms. Daly?
The answer is no, actually, to both questions. I know that it was dramatic. I know it's almost, you were almost talking about a flip-flop. Mm. You know, that's how dramatic it was in the beginning. But I really don't know what the specific figures are, and I don't know what it is now. I'm almost certain that the drug portion of drug offenders has increased dramatically compared to what it had been before. But
and that may have been a bit of a trick question in that, yeah, I was fairly intimately involved at that time. And it seems to me that we went from a ratio of about 60% property offenders and 40% violent offenders to 60% violent offenders, 40% property offenders after the implementation of guidelines, with the stated intent of the legislation being to reserve scarce prison space for those serious and violent offenders. And Dennis, you probably know what it is now.
Ms. Gomez,
for the panel, for the group here, this is fine. I just, since this is being taped, I'm going to have, I guess you'll have to go through with me just so we're taping this, and I don't know who will listen to it, but since it is a public meeting, we'll, okay, Ms. Gomez, do you want to respond?
Basically, as Ms. Daly has suggested, what you see is the property numbers remain the same as they were after the guidelines were implemented. We are not seeing more property offenders committed to prison. But over the years, the drug laws, and two things happened. The drug laws became very, very severe, and so there are lots of people in prison for drugs for longer periods of time. And so if you look at the graph, that drug line, the drug proportion certainly has expanded. And then the other thing was the creation of crimes in a category we call other, which didn't exist years ago. So other includes felony DUI, failing to register as a predatory offender, possession of a handgun by a felon, those things. Those were crimes that did not exist, and there are others. Things that used to be misdemeanors, like fleeing a police officer, that became felonies. So what you see is that we still have, I think the proportion of property and person has not changed so much, but they're in the middle, has infiltrated, drugs and other, and those now, together with property, exceed the person commitments.
Mr. King.
Dan, pull your microphone down.
I'm sorry. Deb, you mentioned in your testimony that that the goals were fairness, equity, and proportionality. And a couple things, there have been multiple changes throughout the years since the guidelines were implemented. First off, and one that is, I don't think, ever been considered, is the creation of collateral punishment associated with certain crimes. The idea that, you have certain things in statute that say if you do this, this will happen to you as far as a correctional response. But then there are other responses that say, if you commit this crime, you can't live in this location, or if you commit this crime, you can't hold this job. And those have expanded exponentially over the past years, and they've been aggravated by the fact that technologically anybody can get that information when it didn't used to be available. And do you have, first off, two-part question. One, do you have a feeling how that impacts on proportionality? And second, I guess, just looking at the guidelines themselves, looking at the changes that have been made over the past 25 years, 29 years, How would you grade us, given A to F, on maintaining proportionality?
Taylor, you want to you want to take a shot at that?
You know, with regard to that first question about the collateral consequences, you know, I don't know that that necessarily relates directly to proportionality in the sense that when the guidelines prescribe what ought to be the sentence for someone who commits a particular crime and is convicted of that particular crime, that particular recommended sentence is based on that. And it's really, I don't believe the guideline system looks at the question of what happens to you afterwards. So in my view, that is a whole different issue for the legislature, for others to kind of face as to what that means and what you're going to do about that, because it's not taken into account when you're sentencing people, and it's a big issue, and I know that there are many that have raised this. On the other one, I I'm going to say that I am a believer in sentencing guideline system, because I really, when I mention those values that I said was part of a sentencing system, I really think that those values are critical to any sound criminal justice policy, and that it is the best system for helping to deliver, you know, those values forward. And you know, accountability is not a small thing, and I believe that the system we have is more accountable than if you had a parole board that was making decisions that may or may not be public, you know, in terms of what you're able to see in terms of their decision-making process, or do anything about it, you know, in terms of their decision-making process. And I believe that despite the fact that there have been challenges over the years to try to get the sentencing guidelines to reflect what we want to do as a state, because everybody's got a different opinion, at least it provides a mechanism for that debate in a way that then the end result is still a structured process for determining what should happen to people who commit felonies and are convicted of felonies in Minnesota. So, you know, it does give you that predictability. It does give you some sense of proportionality. I think that the issues you're wrestling with respect to drug crimes, for instance, are important ones, because they are signaling that something is, astray here with respect to proportionality and uniformity. And if you were to just kind of always let those kinds of things just go and not do anything about them, it does erode that ability of the sentencing guideline system to carry out those values. So, you know, it needs to be taken care of all the time. You know, it's never something that just you put in place and it goes away. But yet I believe that it is probably a system that gives you the ability to best get at the things you want to get at as, you know, as a whole in terms of your public policy around criminal justice.
Mr. Carter has the percentages from 1981 and to today. Gary, can you just some accurate numbers here?
Mr. Chair, these are from the correctional profiles, but let me give you the numbers first, then we'll just make a side note on this. It looks like from 1981, adult inmate profiles, person offense is 49.2%, property 12.7, 5.7 for other offenses. In January of 2007, person offense is 49.2%, property 12.7%, but then they also have drug offenses and some others. And it's interesting to note that on the 7181, drug offenses aren't even noted on
right
here.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. And the offense is 20% of the inmate population are drug offenders.
Mm-hmm.
Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair, I thought it was 24%, but maybe it's gone down a tad since I checked last. And I also think that sentencing guidelines over the years have served us well, having been around for the tail end of the parole board years. I was a caseworker back then. But I do think that we lost some things with the abolishment of the parole board as well. And the one thing that Ms. Daly said that I would take issue with, and that's discretion. I think that everybody who is involved in the criminal justice system has a fair amount of discretion, except corrections. And our discretion is around negative behavior, and it's driven by the due process system. The police certainly have discretion whether or not they're going to arrest. The county attorney has the discretion whether or not they're going to plea bargain the case, and certainly the judge has some discretion regarding they're going to depart up or down or stay within the guideline grid. And I think we lost something there from a correctional perspective when we got away from, as we say, the carrot and the stick. And I hold up the challenge incarceration program as a model that I think there's now research that would support the notion that you hang out an incentive for offenders. They glom onto that, and the results are positive. There are some other pieces that make it work, but I've been an advocate for a while on trying to get a piece of discretion for corrections again, because I think programming has come an awful long way since 1981. We have almost 1,000 inpatient treatment beds. We have 400 sex offender treatment beds. We have vocational training programs that didn't exist. And with 9,000 offenders, we always have waiting lists. But I think there's something to be said for discretion inside the system. Certainly from a prison management perspective, holding out that carrot is a good thing and helps manage that environment, and we see that clearly at the challenge incarceration program. So if I had any criticism of the guideline system, and I'm not saying that we ought to go back to parole by any means, but I think there's room in the middle for some kind of blended system that kind of captures the best of both. And I agree with Isabel and Deb that when you've got 20 or 24% of their population in one crime category, it screams for examination and change. That if somebody, if the folks from 1981 were sitting here today and heard us talking about 20, 22, 23, 24% drug offenders in our $80 a day, $85 a day prison beds, that was not the intent of moving to that system.
I just ask you, Commissioner, of the 20% that, I don't know if the combination, if you consider the drug and DWI offender, that would bring it up to over 27%. But are those offenders also convicted of committing other violent person acts?
Mr. Chair, that would be their commitment offense. They may have something in their history, but their offense of record would be the drug offense.
Okay. Mr. Erickson, please. Did you have a...
No.
Oh, okay.
Good. Thanks.
Then, Mr. Kamen, you're next, too.
The only thing that I would point out is what you just talked about. Dennis just talked about, we have somewhere between 20 and 27, depending upon whether or not you count DWI offenders, percent of our offenders in prison who are quote-unquote drug offenses. And but we also, if I'm not mistaken, have within that crime category the highest departure rate. So in Ms. Gomez talked about a 40% departure rate, and I'm assuming that most of those are durational departures, or not durational, dispositional departures, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and then...
And most of them are downward.
They're pretty much all downward.
So if we followed the guidelines, we're astounded by the fact that between 20 and 27% of people in prison are there for drugs now. But if we followed the guidelines, there would be an additional 40% over and above the number of drug offenders that are there right now, which, you know, I guess I'd ask Ms. Daly, any of the other people in the room, what we would consider to be an appropriate, were guidelines working as they're designed to work, an appropriate departure rate within any given crime category.
Could I?
Ms. Gomez?
I know, Dan, that you were one of the founders of the guidelines, and frankly, at the time that they were founded or created, there was this belief that somehow there should not be departures, you know, that the sentences were so elegantly calibrated that surely that's what everybody ought to get. And I think for those of us who've practiced with the guidelines, we have a really different view. And I would say, as a guidelines commissioner, that departures are essential to the functioning of the system and to justice. The fact that there are these departures does not say that the guidelines aren't working, because the guidelines can only respond to what the crimes are. That is, the guidelines can't create distinctions among different kinds of drug offenders that don't exist in the law. Those guidelines, you know, so I would say that the departure rate is an illustration of one of the functions of the guidelines, which is to show us when practitioners think that the law needs changing. And I think the important thing about those departures that I want to make sure everyone understands is that practitioners are agreeing on those departures. That is, the prosecutors and the judges and the defense attorneys are agreeing on these departures. We very rarely, and we keep the statistics, see prosecutors objecting to these departures. So it's their statement on the part of professionals that lower sentences would be, in some cases, more appropriate. It does, however, that kind of departure rate, from guidelines point of view, is problematical, because, as John Stewart has pointed out, once you've got 40% of the people out of the park, you know, you might as well be back to parole days, because you don't know if they're being proportional. I mean, if those departures are proportionate in the sense that similar people are getting the same departures. And in fact, in response to the commission's request for comments about the re-ranking, what we got were a lot of stories from judges and attorneys about the fact that they felt that many people were not getting the benefit of departures because maybe there were not adequate probation services or treatment options in the community, or because greater Minnesota judges depart more than metro judges do, or...
Less than metro judges do.
Pardon?
The greater Minnesota judges depart less than metro.
Yeah, what did I say? More. That's right, that's correct. And so once, if the law is working properly, the law and the guidelines, and we're all kind of where we ought to be, then there will not be 40% departure rates.
And then we'll go to Mr. Stewart.
Well, first off, let me say that I also am a proponent of guidelines. I was, you know, involved in the early stages, and I don't want to give the impression that I'm not. What I'm trying to convey is that there are certain things that were values, that were goals of the original guidelines, that over time have eroded. And I'm not sure that the erosion was always a planful type of thing. And while I'm a proponent of guidelines, I also don't believe that they're perfect. Don't believe that they ever were, even when we put them on the table in 1980. And, you know, I'm reminded back to when we had the crime, and I'm not sure it's even still in the statutes, of intrafamilial sexual abuse. And when we had 70% of the people who were supposed to go to prison for it that didn't, because the judges in the communities did not agree with our ranking on that particular crime. And I would argue that when you have a departure rate that approaches 50%, you don't have guidelines, you have a coin flip. And the reason why we have a departure rate that approaches 50% is because the corrections community and the judicial community is bailing us out of the decisions that we've made, I would argue, largely for political reasons. We increase, you know, the original philosophy, the guidelines being one of just desserts. It wasn't that just desserts was just picked out of the air as a guiding principle. It's that the other principles were examined for their ability to be applied equitably and fairly. And it was determined basically that rehabilitation couldn't be applied fairly because not everybody had the same need for rehabilitation. Correct me if I'm wrong here, Deb. And incapacitation could not be applied fairly because our best predictive tools for who is likely to reoffend were not much better than a coin flip. So we rejected incapacitation. And we also looked at deterrence. And we determined that deterrence, out of all four principles to be used for sentencing, was probably the least equitably applied. Because, number one, most criminal acts were done as a result of substance abuse or compulsivity, and they couldn't be deterred because they didn't take into consideration the fact that they might be caught. And two, you wound up punishing the lower crime within a given crime category as though it was the higher crime in an effort to scare or convince those people who we'd already determined could not be scared or convinced not to commit the crime because they're afraid of the consequences. And, you know, I mean, having been involved in probably what I think was the most egregious example of, you know, kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the guidelines when in 1989, without any science or anything else, we just basically decided that all the sentences for severity level 7 and below, and I think I understand we've now inverted the guidelines, that they were too low by half and basically doubled them. That was a knee-jerk and political response, and largely responsible for what in many ways turns out to be the inequities that exist in the guidelines today. As time goes on, that it's like any erosion. You know, a little bit of erosion comes along, and it becomes easier for more erosion, and you reach a tipping point. And I would argue that, you know, I totally support Isabel's efforts to try and deal with the drug inequities right now and to any extent possible. But I think that it's also impossible, just like with the situation in Katrina, we may need to rebuild the flood wall at some point and take a look at the level of erosion that continues to happen because, you know, I mean, it's like every time we get a high-profile crime, the Guidelines Commission is under pressure to raise the bar for that particular crime. And the reason why I ask the question for proportionality is at this point we have some crimes that are drug crimes that carry a longer sentence than some murder crimes or manslaughter crimes. To me, that's not proportional.
Now, Mr. Stewart, and I'd like to give Ms. Daly a chance to respond to some of this in a minute.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I just would like to expand a little bit on what Commissioner Benson said, because I agree with his suggestion, and I think it could be the basis for doing some good work here. I go back to before the guidelines also, and I agree that the guidelines were an improvement in an awful lot of ways, and I support a lot of the values in the guidelines. But it seems to me that we're in a position now where we can look at what we gave up, and we can consider the possibility of a blended or a hybrid system with more early release authority. So I'd like to just spend a second on what we gave up. One of the things that we gave up was, once a person was in prison, we gave up the ability to hold him accountable for doing something right, because it doesn't matter. You're going to serve exactly 37.2 months, and that's it, Jack. That's your sentence. As a defense lawyer, I could tell my client within 2 hours when they would be released, 4 or 5 years down the road, pretty much regardless of their behavior, unless they did something really bad in the institution. So I'd say we gave up holding them accountable for doing something right. I think we also gave up a substantial part of the ability to prepare people for reentry. If my release moment is set in stone in the courtroom, why would I go to school or take vocational courses or go to treatment? You know, we gave up a tremendous motivational tool in terms of getting people ready to go back in the community. And the one thing that's true about over 90% of these people that we're talking about that are in prison is that they're coming back to the community. We gave up the belief that people can change. And we gave up a lot of the tools that the corrections department would have used in the past to help people go back. And I've been to the Challenge Incarceration Program. I think it's a real good program. And that's the kind of philosophy that I think would help get the state of Minnesota out of the jam that it's in now. One thing that I think points as a piece of evidence toward what the commissioner said is that we have an awful lot of people going to prison on supervised release violations. I don't know what the numbers are, but there are an awful lot of supervised release violations. And it seems to me that that's part of sentencing people out of a retributive philosophy, where your sentence is an exact number of months that's set in advance. It means that people don't have that incentive to do something right and to prepare themselves to be released. And they get released when that automatic special day comes, and they're not prepared, and they mess up, and pretty soon they're being readmitted to prison again. And I think that's one of the hidden statistics in all this, is that it's a very high rate of people being violated and going back because they didn't have the incentive to get adequately ready to go back to the community.
Let me just say, John, that on the 31st, I believe that's going to be the focus of our meeting, to look at probation revocation and technical violations that are snaring a number of offenders back into prison. But I'm just curious, I agree with everything you said, but Mr. Carter gave me this quote from Senator McCutcheon, who actually was he the author of this bill?
Yeah.
And just to play the devil's advocate of what he was thinking at the time, since I wasn't there, the author stressed that determinancy would bring greater fairness, rationality, certainty, and uniformity to sentencing. Also, I argued that inmates would no longer have to enroll in treatment programs in order to con the parole board into early release. When such game playing ended, treatment programs would become more effective because participation would be voluntary and reflect a genuine desire to change. Just playing devil's advocate.
Mr. Chair, with respect to uniformity is a great ideal, but there's a certain unfairness in treating people as being uniform when perhaps they're not uniform. And I wouldn't mind having Commissioner Benson, after they've served a portion of their guideline sentence, taking a second look. I've been kind of cast as a guidelines opponent. I'm not saying throw out the guidelines, the guidelines have brought us a lot of excellent structure and thinking and values, but give somebody a chance to take a second look at the individual. That's what we lost.
Yeah, the only reason I bring this up is that Representative Eastland and I have been having these discussions for years. And in a bipartisan way, I think this committee has been, the Public Safety Committee, at least in the House, has been saying that we need to make some changes. And I think we're prepared to produce some legislation in the next session. But I want to make sure we're doing it right. And that's so, I want everything on the table and us to have a frank dialogue about what we're doing. Representative Eastland, and then we'll call on Ms. Gomez.
Well, I think the discussion has been interesting, and I guess I've been interested in this topic for a long time. And my perspective is not from the legal profession and the side of this that most at this table are from, but I guess I was a high school teacher for 6 years, and I coached the high school football team for a number of those years, and I'm a parent. I have three kids, and I understand the reason why you have to have uniform rules that apply to everybody, and that's really important. But I also understand that it's not fair to hold every child and every person to the same standard without taking into account their differences. And that's the issue that really strikes at the heart of this from my perspective is I understand when we look at the sentencing guidelines, the values that were mentioned here, you know, we've got fairness, we've got proportionality, we've got accountability. I mean, well, that's wonderful in terms of setting up some rules that are fair in terms of they're administered equally to every person. But the heart of fairness is not treating everybody exactly the same. The heart of fairness is being able to apply principles of discipline that affect people equally, and they might be different principles that are directed to different individuals. And that's what concerns me about our corrections system. And what Dennis mentioned, I think, is really, insightful, that really it's only corrections that doesn't have the discretion anymore. It's like all of this stuff to accomplish all this uniformity has created a system that pours these people into the prisons, and now they have to deal with the real people. The system has been fair, the system has dealt in uniformly, but now they're in prison, and now we can't deal with their individual differences to do what's best for them. So in fact, what we end up with is a system that is a correction system that helps them rehabilitate. And I think that's what I'm struggling with here. I don't know if there's any way to look at what kind of recidivism existed before we had this system, the current system, what kind of recidivism exists today, because there's been a lot of changes in the stereotype of who's in prison. But I guess it would be interesting to look at what's been the effect of the offender, the inmate, in this whole process, and are we really ending up with a better product that's coming out of prison because they all come out. And to me, that should be our benchmark that we should be looking at. Are we really coming out with offenders who are better prepared to re-enter society and to move back to some kind of a productive existence? And that should be what we're measuring this whole thing by. That should be the measuring stick. And I don't know how we do that, but I think that's important from my perspective.
Before I call on you, Isabel, I just want to ask a question maybe of you or also Ms. Daly, because one of the arguments for having sentencing guidelines was to reduce racial bias in the system, if I understand the history of all of this. And it doesn't appear like it has on its face, at least nationally, and I wonder if you could address that vis-a-vis Minnesota and if this 50% departure rate impacts that at all.
I can address that, and in a crazy way, the guidelines have impacted racial disparity recently, in that the incarceration of white people for drugs, which because of meth, has occurred at roughly the same rate as the incarceration of people of color for drugs, and so now we've got lots of white people in prison, and instead of being the worst, having the worst racial disparity in the nation, we have the 12th worst. I'm not happy with any of that. I want to say that the Guidelines Commission has, in fact, formed a collaborative with the state court and with the University of Minnesota Law School. We are trying to raise money privately, and if anybody has any, we'd be glad to have it, to do a groundbreaking racial disparity study, which will be a pioneering study in the world. We're able to do it because of the data that the Guidelines Commission has collected together with what the state court has. I will say that internationally, every jurisdiction in the world has got racial disparity. There's always a population or two that get arrested and so on more. And of course, it's connected to social factors. Minnesota has the greatest disparity between the well-offness of white people and everybody else. So this tends to play out in some very negative ways. If you look at the proportion of African Americans, for example, in our state, it's about 4%. But if you look at all of the murders in the state, African Americans are committing something like 25% and sometimes 30%. That's not because black people are worse. But if you look at the conditions in North Minneapolis, my city, kids I care about, black kids die in Minneapolis, white kids don't. And that's not to do with the inherent goodness or badness of people. Minnesota has a ways to go to look at all these factors. And the guidelines have not, you know, have not, except for this crazy thing with meth and drugs, you know, I wouldn't say that the guidelines have changed racial disparity for the better. I don't think they're capable of that. I don't think there's any kind of sentencing structure that would achieve that. But neither has it made it worse. What we have done is to maintain the lowest incarceration rate in the country, so that if you look at the proportion of people of color per capita who are in prison, there are fewer of them in Minnesota per capita than in any other state because of our incarceration rate. I also want to say I agree totally with everything you said, Representative Eastland, in terms of what's important. And if we had a system in which everybody was treated the same, I wouldn't be sitting here defending it. I was a judge for 23 years. I sentenced thousands of people. It was tough work, which is why I was glad to give it up. And I never sentenced anybody to a sentence that I thought was unfair, except twice when I thought people who were convicted shouldn't have been convicted, and I had to sentence them. I do think that our sentencing laws, you know, give us that room. I also would point out that Minnesota has one of the lowest recidivism rates out of prison in the United States. And so the fact, and we're not in a jam. People come recently, DLC and the Guidelines Commission were visited by the highest level criminal judges in England. Lord Justice Thomas of the High Court of England and Wales. They came to Minnesota to look at the prisons because they believe our prisons are very well run, and they came to look at the guidelines because they've doubled their prison population in the last 5 years, and they were looking at North Carolina and Minnesota guidelines as a possible approach to get a handle on that. I think if we're serious, I mean, you know, this group, we are serious. We're Minnesotans who care about this stuff. If we're going to talk about improving performance outside of prison, we need to talk about the fact that corrections is able to provide chemical dependency treatment to half of the people that it identifies as needing treatment. There doesn't need to be any incentive in the sense that people who need treatment and presumably want it are not getting it because it's not funded. We heard some of us in a Senate hearing concerning sex offenders that the department, when sex offenders come into the prison, evaluate them because we now have good rules for doing that, and they are able to decide on a certain number of people who need sex offender treatment. They have the funding to treat 15%. 85% of the people that the department is able to identify as needing sex offender treatment are not getting it because there's no money to provide it. And so to some extent, you know, I love these philosophical discussions. God knows I run my mouth enough in them. But, you know, we've got to be talking about the real world. There's a story recently about a sex offender, a level 3 kid in his 20s, who's released, and his address when he's released is under the Highway 52 bridge. We talked about housing last week and heard those dismal statistics. If we are, as a state, willing to talk, but to release level 3 sex offenders to an address which is under the Highway 52 bridge, and then punish them and decide that we probably need to commit them because they don't have somewhere other than the bridge to live in at the cost of $400 a day. There's some really crazy stuff going on with money here.
Well, let me just say, I think you were probably present at Senator Berglund's got a subcommittee that's addressing sex offenders and which I'm a member of, so hopefully we'll be more than just talk. But I would like, Isabel, for maybe you to come back when the legislature reconvenes in February to talk about the racial disparities, because it does appear that it is getting worse. If you look at the statistics in 1981, 18.9% of those incarcerated were black, and today it's 32.2%. So that's
I welcome your interest, Representative Paymar.
Okay, let's Commissioner, unless there's some other comments here, I would like you also, Commissioner, to talk a little bit about this model, this idea, give us a little an idea. You know, I realize this is just an idea or a proposal at this point, but is it something that this working group could start to have some discussions about? If you're prepared to do that,
Mr. Chair? I am. But first of all, I've got to take off my corrections hat here and put on my Dennis Benson hat. This proposal does not represent my boss or the department or the executive branch, but it's a very, very loosely put together concept. But again, consistent with what Isabel just said regarding treatment, we do have a shortage of treatment beds. But if we were to do something around, again, within the contours of the guideline grid, giving certain crime categories an opportunity to get out at 50% as opposed to 2/3.
Hang on a second. Would you want the copies of this made or not? Because I'm happy not to.
Yeah, at this point, probably not. I'd just like to have the discussion, and maybe we can firm it up as we move along. But again, if we gave people the opportunity to get out a few months early with some incentives, and the corresponding dollars that we saved were channeled back into chemical dependency treatment, reentry programming, sex offender treatment, I think there's just an incredible amount of money. If we took 6 months off of X number of offenders sentenced every year, we release a lot of people every year. That's a huge, huge pile of money. And you know, life is full of trade-offs. If we really are serious about treating people and providing reentry, providing housing, providing mental health follow-up, both in prison and after they're released, we're going to have to find those dollars within our system. I just don't think that we're going to convince taxpayers that we're going to raise taxes to pay for this. And I think the dollars are there if we just take a look at what we're doing and make some minor modifications. And again, I go back to CIP. There's an awful lot of money. I think it's millions of dollars. If you look at our research that is on our website, I think it's, I want to say $18 million. But the CIP program alone has saved. Now, that would treat an awful lot of offenders on a year-to-year basis. So, again, I don't think we should throw the baby out with the bathwater. I think that guidelines have served us well, but I think there are categories that should have the privilege of the same privilege that those that we put into the CIP program. Give them an incentive to get out a little bit early by doing treatment, by complying with the program review team's recommendation that they make when they come into the system. We used to do something very similar back under the parole board model. We used to call it MAP programming, mutually agreed upon program. I think that was very loosely put together. I think this would have to be much tighter. But the other reason that I think CIP has been so successful is because of the good supervision once they're released. And we really do have a reentry component that accompanies that program. So it's not just what you do in prison, but it's that reentry piece. And again, if we were able to leverage some dollars by letting the right people out a few months early because they did some things while they were in prison, we could also add more intensive supervised release agents, do more home monitoring, make sure they have a home, make sure that they have a mentor out there, they're staying sober. Those people that are under intensive supervised release, they do violate their conditions of release, but seldom do they go out there and do very bad things. We're on them. We know before they do, in many cases, that they're coming back to prison. We do the urinalysis every week, and if we get a dirty UA, we're waiting for them at the halfway house when they get back from work, and we violate them and bring them back if they might be a high-profile offender. So, again, I don't think that doing the right thing here would compromise public safety. The difference between somebody getting out at 30 months as opposed to 40 months or 35 months as opposed to 40 months, I don't think there's any magic in that last 5 months, 6 months, or whatever it might be. So, you know, I think we've leveraged this thing up, as Dan said earlier, some of those under severity level 7. We did that very quickly, and it wasn't well thought out. So, again, use the guidelines, but take a hard look at it and see if there are some things that we could do to generate some dollars to really put some teeth into good prisoner reentry.
I'm curious to see what, Daly, you have any reactions to any of this before I call on the other working group members?
You know, I would just say I fully understand why you want to consider these types of new ways of doing things or old ways of doing things, whatever. It certainly is compelling. The only thing I would just mention in terms of a history lesson, and it really just needs to, you need to be aware of it because it's real, and that is the concept of the system in its integrity. Because one of the issues about the old parole system had to do with the fact that people might have thought somebody was going to prison for 10 years, which of course, really, if you weren't just a person in the public, you'd know that it wasn't going to be 10 years or 20 years, but the public thought it was. They thought they were going to prison for 10 years or 20 years. And so their interpretation then of folks getting out of prison was the concept that they were getting out early. And you know, to some extent, that is not a problem if everything is going smoothly, but when that person that gets out early does something and commits new crime, it's just to point out that you have to be aware of that happening and how you need to have the political will to defend your system that you're going to put in place that will allow what is interpreted as early release or getting out early. So it's that kind of political lesson, you know, and it's actually why we went from good time. We used to have good time for people when the guideline system first went into effect. It was more this concept of here's your sentence and you can get out early if you do these things. And then it changed to bad time because politically folks were concerned about the concept of people getting out early. So I'm only mentioning that because it is a political reality that will more and less surface, and that you just need to know how you're going to deal with those issues and be prepared to, you know, have a system that's defensible about that question.
Thank you. Mr. Weiber.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I like it when you take your corrections hat off, Dennis. It opens up a lot of discussion. Very good ideas. There are a number of ways to kind of lower that prison population. I think we've already done it with the short-term offenders. However, that financial load was thrown on the counties. $10 a day. I know it was just raised in the last session of the legislature, and my goodness, it's all the way up to 30 now. And a cost of 70. The important thing about what Commissioner Benson is talking about is that if we can get some kind of corrective efforts underway, change efforts underway while somebody's in prison, and then get them out early, that's wonderful. But then that falls on the local government. That falls on the local tax levy. The follow-up chemical dependency treatment can't just be while they are out of prison 5 months early. That's probably going to have to last for years, because they're probably going to be on some kind of supervised release. How does that get paid for? Well, there are a number of ways to pay for it, including qualification for federal reimbursement, but that has to start before they get out. Otherwise, the local tax levy spends the first 3 or 4 months picking up the tab. So that's part of the system that has to be changed. And, and the other thing to remember too is that we've got this balloon here, and the prison's over on this end. So we're going to squeeze it to make it smaller by letting people out earlier. Well, what's going to happen? The local supervision then is going to get bigger. There has to be a firm commitment on the part of the legislature that you're going to have to move some money from the smaller part to the larger part. Don't dump that on the local tax levy. That's not fair to the counties, because you put levy limitations on us. And as far as the good time versus bad time that Deb's talking about, why is it that good time is not something you have to earn? Why is good time an apparent constitutional right? You go to prison, I'll let you out. If you're going to prison for 36 months, you get out in 24 if you don't do something wrong. Why isn't it something you have to earn? You've been sentenced to prison for 36 months. If you want to get out in 24, here's what you have to do. You don't have a high school diploma, GED is over there. You have anger management problems. Anger management therapy is right there. You committed your crime or crimes under the influence of alcohol or because of the dependency on drugs. CD treatment's over here. You don't want to participate? Okay, fine. Your cell's over there. And that's where you're going to stay. But make good time something they need. The way good time works right now, it's all negative. Don't mess up. Why not say, do something positive? Do something for yourself so you get out early. But to tell somebody, all you got to do is don't cause a fight, don't get in trouble, and I'll let you out early. What incentive is for them? The only incentive is to behave. There is no incentive to change you as a person. None. There is no incentive for you to correct what got you here in the first place. And that whole concept won't cost much money.
Before I call on you, Mr. King, I'd like the commissioner to respond to both of those issues. Or I won't call you commissioner, I'll call you Mr. Benson.
I agree with Ron. I think that, again, one of the things that I said, if we did find some people to participate in, I don't like the word early release. I think it's an incentive to be released, but bear in mind that we do this now. This is not a new concept. We do this to some degree with work release. We do it with the new CRP program. We do it with CIP offenders. We're now up to 120 beds up at Willow River, and we do it with lifers. So this concept is not a new one, but I think what's happening is we're starting to bastardize the guidelines by adding these
little things incrementally. And if we're, you know, I don't like to see that either. I think if we're going to do it, let's do it. Let's do it methodically and think it through. Now, these people are coming out today or they're coming out in 5 months. The counties are going to supervise them. If we let them out early, again, I think I said that one of the priorities ought to be more agents, more intensive supervised release agents. If they mess that release up, the first order of business would be to come back and serve the time, all of the time, up to the two-thirds or whatever we decided to let them out early, and then accountability time on top of that. I agree with Ron that the good time issue is a negative reinforcement, and we don't like that either inside the system. We don't call it good time anymore. It's extended incarceration time that we add on. And that law changed, I believe, back in about 94, 5, or 6, and it was connected to federal dollars. If you had anything that smelled of early release and not truth in sentencing, you were not eligible for federal dollars to add prison beds. So the good time law or statute was tweaked at that time. Now, I don't necessarily disagree with anything that that Ron said. But again, what I'm proposing is something that is not well thought out. It's a concept that, again, I think we've seen some success, and there's nothing that succeeds like success. I think this would create some money within our system, within your target, that we could do some more efficient spending of those dollars than, you know, the dead time that occurs in prison.
Thank you. Mr. King?
Mr. Chair, Dennis, at least as I recall, and I haven't worked with him closely in a long time with the guidelines, and I ask this question because I know it'll be asked at some point. The guideline, the sentence is broken down into thirds. One-third, two-thirds, three-thirds. The third-third was to be good time, later term, bad time, with very little change in how it was administered, but nonetheless, we like that term better. But there was the ability for discretionary release during that middle term to certain things, which I think is what you were referring to when you talked about work release and other things. How do you answer the people that are going to come back to you and say, can't you already do that, or can't the commissioner already do that?
Mm-hmm.
By expanding work release eligibility by changing those rules.
Well, some of that's committed to statute, particularly with the CIP program, CRP program. Those are statutory guidelines that kind of create the big net, and then, of course, we have our internal policy that drills it down a little bit further. Work release also has, there are some statutory guidelines. And so, I mean, I don't think we would go... Obviously, we're not going to go beyond our statutory authority.
And I understand. I mean, I think that would be a backdoor way to do it, and I certainly think that it makes better sense if you're going to do something, do it in the light of day and just say this is what we're going to do and this is because it's right to do it. But you do have... I remember when the guidelines were created, there was that middle third that was always kind of a hands-off. I mean, Orv Pung never wanted to touch it because... You know, it would give the impression of going back to some type of discretionary release, and I don't know, maybe the ability doesn't even exist anymore, but it did during that time.
Mr. Chair,
Mr. Benson,
I don't think it does. I'm okay. Certainly defer to experts in that area, but I don't believe it does. What we call it now is incarceration time and supervision time. Two-thirds incarceration, one-third supervision, and then we can extend that incarceration time if there are disciplinary issues in the system.
There you go. Mr. Johnson?
Well, I just wanted to agree with Mr. Benson and what he's been saying. I want to point out that best correctional practice would say that if you do some kind of early release with intensive supervision, then treatment needs to be connected with that. If it's not, it statistically doesn't prove anything is any better. It's that treatment component that makes the research look much better.
Let me ask you, Mr. Camp, I don't know where things are at now with the RFPs, I applied. I don't know where that, but assuming that the network was to be the recipient of that, would sort of an experiment, I'm just thinking out loud here, be to use the concept that Mr. Benson is proposing and have those offenders be diverted into your program? And is that, or am I thinking?
Mr. Chair, first off, I don't mean to be ducking the question, but I'm a board member of the network. It's not my program. I'm a founding board member, and because I tend to, be outspoken, I think sometimes I get looked at as point person, and it probably would be better to have Mr. Thomas or Mr. Smith here to answer that. But in answer, to the extent that I can answer your question, I think that were there to be that discretionary release piece, somewhat of a safety valve, they used to refer to it as, but I think unfortunately that conveys the impression that it's something that we do because of population issues as opposed to it's the right thing to do. But were that to be there, I think all community programs that currently contract with the department would be looking towards working effectively with that population. I think particularly in the area of CIP that Commissioner Benson talks about, we found a way to merge programming as the aftercare piece, providing housing and a place for that intensive supervision to take place. I would envision that would also take place with the network, but with the additional wraparound services that are included in the RFP. Long answer, but boils down to yes. I think that would make all the sense in the world.
Thank you. Representative Eastman.
Yeah, I was just thinking about what you said, Mr. Benson. So is what you're saying is that if sentencing guidelines allowed both a good time and a bad time component, so a bad time would mean that you would have the option to extend a sentence to a certain amount, and good time would mean you'd have an option to go the other direction. So someone coming into prison with a five-year sentence and the possibility of a two-year release could lose time, but he could also gain time if he would produce them. Is that kind of what you're suggesting?
Mr. Chair, I think the way guidelines, right now, come in with a 60-month sentence, you automatically get the good time. You get out at 40, and it's presumed that you're going to be released in 40 months as opposed to 60. And again, what the CIP model does is says that you can get out even earlier than the 40. So, essentially that's kind of the concept.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to, I like Dennis's idea, and of course it's just a concept here, and I think the devil's in the details. I spent a short time at corrections before I came to the court system, and I think the more that you can develop a program that provides sort of less discretion politically, the better. As Dennis mentioned, there's a LIFER program at the department, and during my short time there, there were very few people who were released, and some of that is due to politics, as Isabel and others mentioned, worries that somebody's going to get out and do something. Similarly, I think the reason the CIP program is so successful is because if you get in it and you're eligible for it and you successfully complete it, you get that time off, versus work release, where I was also at the department, where over various commissioners, we'd go from hundreds of people in it to very few people in it because the eligibility criteria changed. So I think developing a program that's tied to professionals saying these are the things you need to do, as Dan was saying, when you come into prison, or as Ron was saying, go to DD, get this, get that, and once you do it, you automatically get something. This is the problem that, as Deb was saying, we had politically with parole, where you have so much discretion, people start to challenge it. I don't know if that's the thing going on.
Maybe you know what's going on with that. Well, if you have your cell phone on, please turn it off. That's what. Okay.
But I hate to say anyway, so I'm happy to
hear
that. Mr.
Kane,
then we'll go over here.
Mr. Chair, and I, you know, as Jeff was talking and Dennis was talking earlier, another thing came to mind as an element of the CIP program. And I don't know that this necessarily plays into this or not, but people that get into it actually put some skin in the game, so to speak. Because if they enroll in that particular program and they don't complete it, the time that they spent in it doesn't count. Isn't that correct? So they're putting something on the table. Now, in human behavior, you're going to work a lot harder at being effective on something where you have that kind of investment and that kind of stake. And I wouldn't necessarily hold that out as to the reason for the success of the program. It's a very successful program, but I also would not discount it either. You know, when you're putting 6 months or a year of your freedom on the line, where you're saying, I'm going to invest in this program, and if I don't make good at it, I'm screwed because all that time I spent in there doesn't count. And then I'm going to go out and I'm going to follow through and I'm going to be there when my supervised agent comes to show up. I'm going to be at this job. Because if I don't, you know, not only will I be returned to prison, but I'll be returned as though none of that time counted. That's a real strong incentive.
Mr. Chair, I think this is really productive. I think this is a real good idea. But going back to where we were an hour ago, I think it just really solves one of the major problems. There are also the issues that Ms. Gomez brought up about the threshold amounts and about defining the kingpin and about the different plea bargaining and discretionary sentencing patterns in different parts of the state. I think you've got a pretty good answer on the table here for the person that gets the 60 months. But that person that might get the 60 months in the metro area, if they were someplace else in the state for the same conduct, they might be getting 90 months or 120 months because that part of the justice system doesn't do downward departures, for instance. So there are several pieces that could use having you think about whether they should be adjusted. And this proposal that Commissioner or Mr. Benson has got here, this is terrific, but it's not a total solution to the picture that I believe brought the group here today.
And Mr. Stewart, do you have any ideas?
Well, Mr. Chair, gosh, thank you. One idea I have is that the this is so hard to do because there's so much pressure about this issue. But the drug laws that we have need a tune-up. There are so many situations in which a person who is really just supporting a habit by buying a small amount and selling part of it
can get to look like a, quote, pusher or a, quote, dealer. And as long as you have a presumptive sentence of 86 months for 10 grams, if you find a way to let the person earn 6 months off that 86 months, that's a very, very good thing, and I applaud you for that. But there are some other pieces that are upstream from there that could use having a look be taken at, too. There are these questions over who is really a seller, who's a kingpin. I think that there are some very dangerous, predatory, drug-dealing folks that richly deserve to get 86 months. But I also know there are a lot of nickel and dime guys that are getting 86 months in rural parts of the state because the county justice system there, the county attorney and the local judge say, well, we don't depart here. You know, there are a lot of counties that don't give 15218, which is the diversionary sentence for a first-time drug possession crime. You've had a bill before you a couple of times to make it a more presumptive type of thing to give 15218 on the first offenses. That's the type of thing that could be looked at in addition to trying to do the thing that Dennis is talking about.
Ms. Gomez, I just, because I've been briefed a little bit about this, but you're the Sentencing Guidelines Commission is looking at the adjustment to the grid based on the bill that was passed in the last legislative session. Can you, again, I know you briefly talked about it at the beginning of this meeting. Where is that now?
The commission voted on a re-ranking of that is responsive to the statute. And it, to the statutory mandate, it is, it will not have a lot of impact. It will have some, and there's a public hearing on that proposal, and following for November 1st, and following that, the commission then presumably after hearing the comments will formally vote to make that adjustment.
And what would the adjustment be?
I don't want to state it because I'm afraid I'm going to get it wrong. Jacqueline, do you remember clearly enough to be able to articulate it?
Can you come up, please? Mr. Knuth, can you come up here, too, if you don't mind, if you'd like to offer any quick comments about this? You don't have to. I'm not asking you to, but if you would like to.
This is Jacqueline Krauss, who's one of our senior researchers and so young.
I'm sorry, would you state your name, please?
Sure. Jacqueline Krauss.
Okay.
The proposal that was voted on and approved by the commission was a proposal to re-rank first-degree and second-degree possession crimes. So those would each be lowered one severity level. So possession, first-degree possession would become an 8 instead of a 9, and second-degree possession would become a 7 instead of an 8. But both of the sale offenses at those levels and the manufacture of methamphetamine would be left as they currently are.
That was what the recommendation was from the legislature, wasn't it, Ms. Gomez? Or is that?
It's more actually because of our law, which does not distinguish very well between actual sales and presumption or possession of an amount of drugs that in other states might be treated as a misdemeanor. People get convicted for sale when what's proven is that they possess a fairly, in fact, a very speaking comparatively with other states, a small amount of drugs. So, and included in that same category are people who actually are selling and are actually making their living selling, and that's the trouble. Our sales category is huge, and it sweeps up so many people that if you don't make any adjustments in rankings there, you still have a lot of the anomalies that were pointed out in our drug report. And the reason I didn't want to get into it is because there are certain, you know, numbers of months and so on that I'm not, that I don't trust myself about, and sort of muddy the discussion. But what I'm saying is that the commission had several options. I mean, had four. We came up with, the staff came up with. We could see four ways that, given our present statutory structure, we could do re-ranking. And the commission selected the most conservative. And the bed impact is, there is some bed impact, but not, it was the most conservative proposal. The result is there are not tons of people impacted. We can bring you, or send you, Representative Paymart, the exact numbers of people who would be impacted. But I don't remember them today.
Smith, do you want to? It's totally up to you, but do you have anything you'd like to say, because you've been working on this issue? It's up to you.
Mr. Chairman, I tread very lightly in front of this committee. But one of the things that I've been working on this issue for about 5 years, and one of the things that we found is that the people in the state of Minnesota are far beyond what decision makers are at this point. And I can't tell you exactly why that is. There was a poll that was done back in, it was 2 years ago actually, in Valentine's Day, that indicated that Minnesotans would prefer shorter sentences and more treatment by about a 65-70% margin over the 35 or whatever the math is showing. As you remember, when you were on the committee, that Representative Lippman and Representative Ellison tried to change the amounts and the for various drug crimes and change the sentence. Got a very good hearing, but somehow it magically disappeared. Now there's been a re-ranking, and that there's been an analysis done and a decision that's been made that does indicate that there will be at least some reduction of individuals that will be going to prison. If I remember correctly, and I'm not sure, my memory is probably a little bit fresher on this than Executive Director Gomez, but there'll be some, about 200 plus people that will not be going to prison because of this re-ranking, and that there will be about another 100 or so plus that would get shorter sentences. So that would have some impact on the bed amounts, considering that depending on how you look at the per diems, whether it's $80 to $100 a day, depending on how it's being calculated, which would free up some money for additional treatment or some additional programming. Obviously, as an advocate, is this what the magnitudes that I'd like to see? No. But given the realities of what we see, it's perhaps a very good start.
Ask Mr. Benson is next, and then I do want to see if anyone in the audience does want to address the working group. Mr. Benson?
The only thing I wanted to add, Mr. Chair, is with respect to Ms. Daly's comments regarding parity, I think that is critical, and we did learn a lesson back in the 70s, and I think whatever we do, if we do something, it ought to be within the contours of the guidelines, and it ought to be not just helter-skelter
letting people out a little bit early, but it should be well thought out. It should be driven by treatment completions and some results kinds of things, again, consistent with the best practices that we know do work. And to Gary's comment, too, I think we talk about 80, 85% of the people that come into the system at least abuse chemicals, if not are addicted. So treatment is a huge, huge piece, and the mental health piece that we discussed last time is another huge piece that I think we've got to pay attention to. So I think that, again, we can take the best of the guidelines and just build in some pieces of discretion that we know work through recent experiences, although CIP's been around now since 92, I believe, so we have a fair amount of data on which to base this decision if we move in that direction. So, and then to Jeff's point, too, I think that is critical, that we don't tie this thing into some kind of politically charged release authority or who gets this privilege or who doesn't. It really has to be very methodical if we're going to avoid some of those pitfalls that history has presented us with.
Ms. Daly?
Yeah, I just wanted to follow up on that because I really didn't use that term, truth in sentencing, which really was the driving factor in moving from indeterminate to determinate sentencing, that we would know up front when the judge pronounced the sentence what it was a person would, how much time they would spend in prison. And I think that it just needs to be recognized that it's a very delicate balance. You know, all these things, it's difficult, very, very difficult to reach a point where you kind of have everything kind of working together. And, you know, when you change something on one end, like you add some discretion over here, the likelihood is you're going to change some behavior over here. And just to be aware of that, for instance, a judge sitting on a bench knowing that this person could be released after serving half of their time if they do certain things might be more inclined to give them a particular sentence than they would if they thought they would serve two-thirds of that time. Mm-hmm. So, that you just need to keep in mind that when you start to do this sort of changing of discretion, it does affect other people's discretion. And, you know, you're never going to be able to figure it all out in terms of how will we get it totally right. It's all a matter of just, working with it and thinking about those ramifications. But I wanted to at least mention that because, in places with parole systems, it does require that recognition of what happens when you put discretion over here, what happens to the discretion over here.
Senator Higgins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions. One for Commissioner Benson. Is there an average amount that is spent for chemical dependency treatment while folks are incarcerated, or is it just hard to figure out a kind of a ballpark number?
Mr. Chair and Senator Higgins, I think we have some data on that, but what we have done is it's included in our per diem of the $80-plus dollars a day. The chemical dependency treatment is part of that. I know we just went through this with respect to sex offender treatment, and I think that number was around $22 a day. I think CD is less than that.
Okay.
I think it's in the neighborhood of $14, $15 a day. But we lump that into the total per diem, but it's okay, in that range.
And then, Mr. Chair, my other question is for Judge Gomez. Were the two categories, I know that we, in the legislation, asked that the commission look at our sentences compared with surrounding states and national numbers and all those kinds of things. And I'm curious about whether those two categories that the commission decided to recommend changes for were the only two that were really out of whack, or how that fits all in there.
I'm a little bit in Mr. Benson's situation here, in that I guess I will simply say that the scope of the the proposed modification is such that it does not do a lot to bring us into line with other states.
And Mr. Chair,
it does something.
Yeah. Did you get a sense that the commission was unwilling to make big changes at this point? Or, I mean, this is a pretty modest proposal that it sounds like you're coming forward with, and did you get a sense of the commission on whether that was all they were willing to do, or I think we have some new members. Tell us about how that decision came about, please.
Well, I think the best, you know, to get the whole flavor, probably, you know, we do have tapes, and certainly, I'm not too facetious about that. You know, you could hear the tapes of maybe three meetings, but I would say that the commission could, that it, a more expansive modification could not pass in the commission.
Let's go to Eastland, and then I'm just going to ask if anyone, does anyone want to speak to, but let's, President Eastland, why don't you go first, and then...
Okay, thank you. I was just thinking about your comment, Ms. Daly, about the consequences could be that those get bigger sentences, you know. But I think as we thought about this and thought about what Mr. Benson said, if what we're trying to say is what we're trying to do is just provide an option for a little bit earlier release. We're not looking to let people out a year or two or three early, I mean, necessarily. But you know, so like right now, in a 16-month sentence, they would be presumed to be able to get out in 40 months unless they did something bad. Is kind of the way it works. I mean, if right now, if we would change it to something like if they, on a 60-month sentence, they would get out at 50 months, unless they did something bad, but they could get out at 35 months if they did some stuff good. I mean, what we'd be doing is just, we'd be saving 5 months. We'd be getting them out a little bit early, rather than 40 months. But I guess the question that I had, would go to you, Dennis, in that you said something about we want to avoid a politically charged situation where we're releasing people early. Could you just give us a little bit of your thoughts about how that could look? How could we design a system that wouldn't be politically charged?
Mr. Benson, I want to try to end about five here. So again.
Well, again, to the extent that it were possible, I think that the guidelines and rules being committed to statute kind of take some of that mystery out of it, as opposed to like parole boards and the department has some discretion with respect to who gets into CIP, but then if they complete it, you know, they get the time off their sentence. So if that's spelled out in statute, again, it takes the mystery out of it, and as opposed to, I don't think corrections wants to play God either. With when I say discretion, I just think that, you know, these things that we know work, we ought to expand that conceptually to some other categories.
John?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Kendry, speaking on behalf of the Minnesota County Attorneys Association. Since I heard the word county attorney mentioned, I thought I should come up and say just a very couple of very brief words. It's funny how you come to a hearing on parole board and all of a sudden it turns into a sentencing discussion. As you might suspect, we do have a position on parole boards. The last time this body debated it was back in 2005. I think it is fair to say that any sentencing decisions, any future direction should be in a context, as has been mentioned earlier, within sentencing guidelines. We believe that that is the most appropriate way to address a number of the issues that were discussed today. We have a number of people, some around this table, that argue where the debate should take place. Some would argue that it should maybe take place within sentencing guidelines. I think we might argue that it should be more open and take place here at the legislature or other larger public forums, with no disrespect to sentencing guidelines. Also, with regard to the proposal from sentencing guidelines that is on the table, the current debate within our organization is, should we push for greater systemic change, which would involve coming back here, talking about weights and other issues, sentences and other issues that have been discussed around the table, or a more incremental approach, as I think Mike best described what's on the table right now from sentencing guidelines. When you look at our at the various localities around the state, especially Minneapolis, you ask them, what's your big issue? Marijuana. Marijuana is the big, major issue in Minneapolis. I hear that time and time again. Other places around the state, there are different kinds of drugs. Methamphetamine is still a major issue across the state. But when you look at our two cities here in St. Paul and Minneapolis, it's completely different. And whatever approach is that ultimately is done is going to have to address that issue. I've heard that consistently over the last 9 months. As you might suspect, in any kind of debate, you always have dueling statistics. And we've heard some discussion about the number of folks that go to prison for lengths of time and so forth. Yes, we've looked at it. Yes, we've developed a position paper. Yes, I will provide it to you. It's a nice little 16-pager. It's in response to what was on the table. And even since the decision, since the vote by sentencing guidelines a couple of weeks ago now, some of those numbers, again, I think they're good solid numbers, but people can disagree on them. I've heard just a couple of folks which mentioned some issues, which I'll talk to the staff about afterwards. But I will send you our paper and obviously look forward to continuing the discussion with you and all members of the legislature.
Thank you for your testimony. Anyone else want to have a brief comment? Just going to give you, we're going to end in a couple minutes here, so if you want to just have some closing.
Thank you, Representative Tamar. I really do just want to clarify a little bit the commission's position, because I don't want to sound overly mysterious about that. I think the bottom line with the commission is that there is a very strong sentiment on the commission that major changes should be made by the legislature. And notwithstanding the particular way in which that mandate evolved, I think there was, in fact, I know, there's a hesitance on the part of the commission to make big changes. And that's the bottom line. And partly it tied in with in what we just heard from Mr. Kingry, a belief that somehow there ought to be a discussion in the legislature that would precede further change. And also, I mean, everybody's agreement that the law has to change, that just re-ranking is just not adequate. So just so I can, you know, say how that.
Thank you. Okay, so, well, I'd like to thank Deb Daly for taking time out of your day to give us the history of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and all of you for an interesting discussion. The next meeting is scheduled
17th.
On the 17th, and in room 5 of the State Office Building at 3 o'clock. And the content or the agenda for that is on employment issues for offenders being released. Any topic, we only have a couple meetings left, and we're going to close down then our function, but any issues that you would like to see addressed, or handouts that you think might be appropriate for people to educate themselves before the last two meetings on that topic, as well as violations of probation, please get that information to Ms. Lacombe so she can get them to the working group so we can have that in advance. Are there any...
Representative Tamar, I'm not sure that this impacts on too many other people, but I know it impacts on probably Ron and Dennis, but the 17th is right in the middle of the Minnesota Corrections Association conference, which is taking place in St. Cloud, and I doubt very much whether I would be able to make the next meeting. Dennis won't be able to make it. I don't know about...
I won't be here.
There are a number... Gary probably be up there. Could be a fairly sparsely attended Andy will probably be up there.
I've never been to one, so I'll be here.
Okay.
Melanie, is there another option here, or is there another date that would work better? We wanted to get two more meetings in and before we concluded our
24th.
Work by
24th. We left 24th, Mr. Chairman.
24th and 31st.
Yeah, 24 and 31. Yeah.
Okay.
Great.
Okay. So Melanie will send out notices and information agendas. So
I'm not gonna be
again, thank you all for coming.
Thank you.